for this second morning of the retreat. Having done a full day of aiming for quiet, peaceful states of mind, obviously you find it's not as easy as it sometimes sounds to be able to quieten the mind down. Again, I will remind everyone of the stages of meditation which I'm teaching here at the beginning of this retreat. The first stage of continuous awareness of the breath. The second stage of continuous full awareness of the breath. And then calming that mental object down to arouse the samadhi nimitta. And please keep those instructions or those stages in mind, because then you know where you are. You know the instructions, you know the path. But as we go along that path towards meditation, there are obstacles which will come up. And I'm sure you've met many of those obstacles already. And it's important, as you're meditating, if you are unable to attain any of those stages, if there is something stopping you, then find out what it is that's stopping you, what the problem is. Because it's only when you find out what the problem is, you have a chance of finding its solution. So the problem fades away, you can go deeper into meditation. And the way the Buddha taught, he taught the problems or the obstacles to meditation success as the five hindrances. And those five hindrances in brief are karma chanda, which means the desire or the interest in the realm of the five senses, in particular that desire or interest which seeks pleasure or comfort in the realm of the five senses. And that even includes thoughts and fantasies in the mind which are connected with that world of the five senses. That's all part of this enormous hindrance called karmachanda. The second hindrance is vyapada or ill will, which is very much related to seeking for pleasure or discomfort. Seeking for pleasure or comfort. Because if ever one fails to get the pleasure or comfort which one seeks, very often it gives rise to frustration and ill will, wishing to blame, wishing to hurt, wishing to destroy. And that is also a hindrance in the mind. The third hindrance is a sloth and torpor, which is very easy to see first thing in the morning when you get up at 4 o'clock and do the first sit. And then there's restlessness and worry, which you can see very easily after you've had a couple of cups of coffee, the restlessness of the mind. And the last hindrance is like doubt, which happens during the meditation, not quite knowing what you're supposed to be doing. And those are what the Buddha calls like the five hindrances. And to go over them in a bit more detail, because hopefully by talking about these things, that you'll get to know them very well. And once you know them very well theoretically, you'll be able to recognize them experientially when they actually occur during your meditation. And if you can recognize them experientially, then you know, this is, say, karmakanda. This is the first hindrance happening here. And once you can recognize it experientially, you notice what it is, then you'll find you can do something about it. And these hindrances, a lot of them are not that hard to overcome. The problem is actually recognizing them in the first place, knowing what the problem is. Sometimes there'll be a group of hindrances together, you know, two or three of them all mixed up, but one will always be the dominant hindrance. And so you check that one out first of all and see what you can do to overcome it. But as it actually is, in my experience as a meditator and also teaching meditation, the most powerful and most common of the hindrances is the first one. Perhaps that's why the Buddha called it number one in the list of five hindrances, is the karma chanda. And sometimes that it's translated as sensual desire or sensual lust, but it's much more than that and goes far deeper than that. The karma chanda is, as I've been talking quite a few times already on this retreat, is that the concern with the comfort of the body, concerned with gaining some sort of satisfaction with the external five senses. And as such as being concerned with sounds, with sights, and especially with feelings. Not so much with sights in this place, not so much with sounds, although sometimes that the desire to gain comfort in the realm of sounds will sometimes manifest as being irritated with the noises and things which you take to be obstacles to your peaceful meditation. But there's also the physical feelings as well in the body. This is also part of karma chanda, like desire for satisfaction and pleasure, comfort in this realm of the five senses. Sometimes it can manifest as just thoughts of physical pleasure, thoughts of beautiful food, thoughts of sexual fantasies, thoughts of dreams and all sorts of thoughts and imaginations. Sometimes in the retreat you can write a whole book, whether it's a horror movie or a romance novel, it really depends upon how it's going in the retreat, or happening in the mind. This is all part of karma chanda. I think some of you might know that story of a monk who's a friend of mine in Thailand. He was staying with a teacher who was a very renowned meditator, and he used to meditate 2 hours every evening. And sometimes in the hot weather in Thailand, after a difficult day, he used to have a bit of trouble with sloth and torpor, sleepiness and dullness. And this one session, instead of watching his breath, for one reason or another, he decided just to think about sexual matters. And he had this beautiful sexual fantasy for 2 hours. And he said he wasn't at all tired or sleepy or dull. And it was only afterwards, that towards the end of the meditation, it went very, very quickly, he started to think, my teacher's a great meditator. And everyone says that he has these special psychic powers. I wonder if he's read my mind. I wonder if he knows what I've been doing all this time. And sure enough, at the end of meditation, this monk came up to him and looked him right in the eye. You know what he said to him? He said, "You've just been wasting your time for 2 hours. That's all." And then he went away. It was a very, like, compassionate, but also very skillful teaching. It's just wasting one's time if one dwells in that sort of realm, the realm of karma chanda. Not wasting anyone else's time, just wasting one's own. Because it's a hindrance. You're blocking off something which is far more beautiful, far more wonderful, far more useful. And it can become a habit to dwell with that sort of karma chanda, because as that monk experienced, you know, you don't have to put forth much effort, because sensual fantasies, sexual fantasies are like pleasant. They have a degree of pleasure attached to them. And so the mind can very happily occupy itself for quite a few hours just dreaming of such things. However, that is going to be the hindrance to the meditation blisses. It's going to keep you at a very, very low level of consciousness rather than allowing you to transcend that realm and go far, far deeper. So if that's happening, know that this is karma chanda. This is the very first hindrance. And if one cannot give that up, then one is throwing away the opportunity to really train the mind and really gain some bliss in this meditation. Not only that, as I mentioned again, mentioned earlier, that not just the desire for pleasure, but the desire for comfort is also part of karma chanda. Be careful that desiring for comfort, because sometimes it can be the most comfortable position when you're trying to sit down. The biggest cushion, that's the There's a story of Ajahn Chah, that one day that somebody was listening to a talk, sitting on this, you know, the hard concrete floor, and asked if he could have a cushion. So he was given a cushion to sit on, just special permission to sit on a cushion. But then sitting on a cushion on the floor, again, it was a bit too hard on his back, so he asked for a chair. And Ajahn Chah said, hang on. So first you ask for a cushion, then you ask for a chair. Next you'll ask for an armchair. Next you'll ask for a sofa. Then you'll ask for a bed. Then you'll ask for a bed with many mattresses on. Because when will you ever find sort of the comfort in the body? And you've got to be careful there, because if you give in to the body too much, then you'll find that the body will just go to the, what you say, the lowest center of gravity, which is usually on the floor. And seeking comfort that way, there's just no end to it. It usually ends in dullness. There's an interesting point there, because you can see that sometimes seeking for physical comfort or mental comfort can often lead to the third hindrance of sloth and torpor. The two are very intimately connected there. Sometimes to keep awake and keep alert, sometimes it's a little bit of discomfort, first of all. And sometimes we want to escape from that discomfort just by going into sloth. But I'll talk about that again in a few moments when I get to that third hindrance of sloth and torpor. The first hindrance of Kamachanda. Really concern about the comfort of the body, or the pleasure which is connected to the body. Now remember, this meditation is in order to let go of the body, to transcend the body, to liberate the mind from the body. So we have to discipline the body a little bit and just look for a pleasure which is higher and more delicious than the pleasures of the five senses. And the way to overcome Kamachanda, or sensual desire, or sensual comfort, again, this is referring to the five external senses. First of all, that method of meditation which I've been teaching here is an automatic path to the elimination of that hindrance and all other hindrances. By deliberately putting your attention on the breath and taking away from other things, that the mind hasn't got space to go into sexual fantasies or sensual fantasies or dreams or worrying about comfort of the body. It hasn't got the opportunity to do so. Even if one gets to that first stage of meditation, or just continuous awareness of the breath, you can only sort of fantasize for a few seconds before you have to come back to catch the next breath. Then you can go off again, but you have to come back again. You cannot have that full indulgence in sensual thoughts if you can manage to get to the first stage of meditation. And especially if you can get to the second stage of meditation, there's no room in the mind at all for such thoughts, because the mind's completely occupied with the breath and nothing else. So sensual thoughts, or thoughts of comfort, disappear when you attain that second stage in this meditation. Kamachanda has gone at that point. And that's why I was saying earlier that this is such an important stage to reach, where you can get continual full awareness of the breathing, because you're getting rid of the hindrances at this point. If you have trouble with these hindrances, sometimes they can only really be overcome either through some faith and confidence that there's something better than this, or even better, through experience. If I can only experience a few times the bliss of deep meditation, then that will weaken immensely the delight in the external five senses. Once you know that there is actually something more beautiful, more delicious, more enjoyable, then you have an opportunity, a chance of giving up the lesser for the greater. But until you achieve one of those states, sometimes one just has to go on confidence and faith. But there is something worthwhile to be gained by letting go of Kamachanda, sensory desire, and going deeper into the mind. And hopefully that one will be able to experience in this retreat at least a taste of that which is greater and more blissful. And the memory of that will be a beautiful help to overcoming Karma Chanda in the future. When you know what you will gain by paying no attention, not getting interested in the world of the five senses. The Buddha described like someone who has Karma Chanda, like someone who's being in debt, a debtor. And that was a simile the Buddha used. Because in the realm of the five senses, that pain and pleasure go along as a pair. And as it were, that all pleasure has to be paid for later on by pain. All pain has to be balanced by pleasure. Because the world of those five senses, that pleasure is just the gap between two painful experiences. Pain is just the pause between two pleasurable experiences. So the degree of pleasure is measured by the pain which preceded it. Just as like students doing their TE examinations, they experience great pleasure when those examinations are finished. Why is that? Because of the pain of actually studying so hard and worrying and doing those examinations. That's the origin of that pleasure. It comes from the pain which went before. The great joy and exuberance of like a man and a woman on their wedding ceremony, that is a result of all of the striving and the hope and the dreams which went before it. It's all, as it were, paid for by the pain which went before. This is the truth of our sensory experience. It's only daytime because of the night which preceded it. Otherwise we wouldn't call it daytime, we wouldn't know it was daytime. And that's why the Buddha called like sensory pleasures a debt. They were borrowing. They have to be paid for later on when that pleasurable experience ceases and there's an emptiness there. There's that little longing for it to be repeated. And that longing, that thirst, that hunger of wanting the pleasure to be repeated is the pain. It's where one has to pay back the debt. Because these pleasures are not yours. You cannot control them. As it were, you borrow them from others. That's why the Buddha called it a debt. He also called it in a simile of, he gave a simile of like a glass of water or a bowl of water. And he said this is like the water or the body of water is always a very common simile for the mind. And he said the Karma Chanda, the hindrance of sensuality, is like putting various colours in the water. So you don't actually see the mind, you just see the colours. It's very similar to the metaphor I used earlier of a children's colouring book. We have the white pages with the black lines and you put the colours in. And so the sensuality, the sensory happiness which you think is there is what you add to this experience. It's adding colours. And when you put colours, it's the colours which fascinate you and take your mind away from the reality of the peaceful, blissful mind. This becomes like the Karma Chanda, which is a hindrance in meditation. Let go of concern for sights, smells, tastes, sounds and touches. Let go of concern for them. Abandon the concern for them. And put your concern on your meditation object. First of all on the breath, then on the limiters which arise in the mind. And don't go back to the world of the five senses until you really have to. Then you understand the overcoming of Karma Chanda, of the first hindrance. Another way of overcoming that hindrance, because sometimes sounds, physical feelings, and thoughts of past pleasures and pains sometimes can come up and disturb the mind when you're meditating. And a good way of overcoming that, and a good way of understanding how it's overcome, is imagine your mind as a big screen, like a movie screen. And The point of the movie screen simile is that in a part of that movie screen will be your focus of attention, the area where you're looking and staring at. And the other areas of that screen, which are, as it were, on the periphery, on the edge. And what you focus on, what's the center of your screen, eventually becomes dominant. And what's on the edge of the screen starts to fall away and fade away, to eventually disappears. When people turn on their television set and they're watching a movie, they may see the pot plant on top of the TV at first. But as they watch the TV longer and longer, they don't notice the pot plant on top of their TV. They don't notice the switches and dials on the edge of the TV. The mind focuses just on the screen and doesn't see any edges at all. In the same way that when one begins the meditation, one may have, as it were, a mind like a screen with many things on it, and you'll choose one part of that screen where you focus your attention, focusing your attention on the breathing. There may be other things which you are aware of at the same time on the edge of the screen. But make sure that you center your attention, you keep the focus on the breath. Because if you center and keep the focus on the breath, you'll find your screen will narrow down. Sounds, physical feelings, stray thoughts, being on the edge would eventually fall off and disappear. And all you're left with is just the experience of breath. Be careful not to focus the attention on, say, the sounds. Because if you put the sounds which you're hearing at the center of your screen, of your mind, then you find the breath falls off and you've lost it. It really depends on what you center on, where you put your focus, what's the main thing you're looking at in your mind. That's how meditation works, by choosing to make the main object in your mind when you're meditating the experience of breath. And bit by bit, these other things, which were on the edge of the screen and you could be conscious of at first, afterwards disappear. So karma chanda, make sure that if it's there at the beginning, it's on the edge of your screen. And don't center on it. You keep the mind on the breath, then the karma chanda will eventually disappear. The last thing I want to say about karma chanda is karma chanda, the sensory desire which is connected with the realm of the five senses, has no connection at all with the joy and the happiness of the sixth sense of the mind. And in fact, if there was not a joy and happiness of the mind, there would be no way of fully overcoming and releasing oneself from the joys and pleasures of the body. Only, you can only give up pleasures by gaining higher and deeper pleasures. It's the only way. And so, whenever there is a pleasure which is associated with the mind, the Buddha constantly said, do not be afraid of that pleasure. Do not abandon that pleasure, but develop and cultivate that pleasure, because it leads to enlightenment. So the pleasures of the mind, the bliss states, the feelings of peace, the joy of peace, the happiness of having let go of a great burden, all of these pleasures and happinesses, the joys of meditation, these are something which one can indulge in, one should indulge in. One can develop and have a great time. Many pleasures in the world have always got their bad side effects. It seems that the most delicious food is bad for you. The most enjoyable pleasures have all these diseases attached to them. And so often it seems that pleasure and happiness always has some downside to it. And the pleasures and happiness of the mind the Buddha said, has got no downside to it at all. The pleasures and happinesses of the mind, the opposite of karma tanda, is to be developed and not to be feared. So that's why we can overcome karma tanda. The concern and worry, even the thought, this other word, karma vitaka, which is the most refined form of karma tanda. Karma vitaka is the thought concerned with sensual pleasure. So this is what we abandon and give up. The second hindrance is called ill will, vayapada. In its coarser form, it's like carrying hatred, revenge, wanting to harm or to hurt, or even thoughts of harm or hurt towards another person or another being, which can be the mosquito which is buzzing around your ear. I know last night that a few mosquitoes were biting, but the one which irritated me the most was not the one which bit, the one which was buzzing, 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 buzzing. Come on, bite me and get it over with. Buzz, 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 buzz. That mosquito, I think, was a sadist. We just wanted to tease and not really to bite. And so sometimes you get vayapada towards these little irritations, which you think are the cause for obstructing your samadhi. But of course, it's not the mosquito, it's not the person, it's not the sound of the aeroplane or whatever. It's your reaction to it. That's where vayapada comes from. That's the obstacle. So vayapada is compared by the Buddha to like boiling water. When the mind is boiling, hot, steaming, then again, you can't really see into its depths and fully understand its nature. He also compared it to like being sick. So nothing agrees with you. And if you've got like a sick stomach, then whatever food you put into it, especially not nice food, beautiful food, you tend to get a stomach ache afterwards. And that's why a pardon, nothing agrees with you. It's also, in its more refined state, it's sometimes called by the Buddha to be the fault-finding mind. And this is what I want to dwell upon with this hindrance, the fault-finding mind. I know that Ajahn Sumedho telling me once that there was a meditation center in the United States, in Barrie, which is the most plush, five-star, beautiful, well-set-up meditation center you could ever hope for. And it's got everything. And one day they decided to put a complaints box in there, suggestions box, just to see what people thought and if there was anything they could improve upon. And they found that in that centre there was more complaints and suggestions than any other centre. No matter how much trouble they went to make it absolutely perfect, in fact, the more trouble they went to make it perfect, the more imperfect people found it to be. And after a while you realise it wasn't the centre, because the centre was as good as you could make. It was the people, the fault-finding mind, can find fault in anything. The most perfect, wonderful situation you can find fault with. Look at these bricks. These rotten bricks are all over the place. Can't we have anything else except just bricks on these buildings? The food, wonderful, delicious food. Can't we have anything, something else except like health food for a change? Why don't we have a hamburger once for a change? Whatever it is, like, the fault-finding mind can find fault with anything. And especially with oneself. Sometimes one gets into a fault-finding mood and you can find fault with the teacher, you can find fault with the food, you can find fault with the beds you sleep on, you can find fault with yourself. My meditation cushion isn't good enough. It's either too soft or it's too hard. It's not the right shape. I can't get it right. You ever done that before? Just you got your zafu and you keep pushing it this way and you can't get it right. You can't get it perfect. That's like a fault-finding mind again. This is where like aversion comes from. where Vyapada is born, by finding fault. Why can't we move this meditation center where there's no planes overhead? This is very important, my meditation retreat. Can't someone arrange for the airport to close down for 9 days so we can have some peace and quiet here? Or someone starts talking to you. This isn't right. Why should someone talk? This is supposed to be noble silence. This is against the rules. And apparently sometimes one person talking to you once can spoil your whole retreat. A fault-finding mind. That's all it is. If they've said something to you or something's gone wrong, leave it there. Let it go. Don't find fault. There's a hindrance, a Vyapada. Actually, that happened in a retreat some time ago. It's supposed to be a noble silence retreat. Somebody was working in the kitchen, and then someone came up to them and started a conversation. And the person thought, well, I'm supposed to be sensitive and kind and pleasant. So they answered back. And for the rest of the retreat, they were fault-finding. Now, people shouldn't talk. They shouldn't disturb me. I'm trying to keep silence. It's so hard to get a retreat. I'm so busy with my life and do so many different things. This is my holiday. This is my retreat time. And they spoiled it for me. This is wrong. It shouldn't happen this way. They should be banned. They should never come to a retreat again. But that's like the fault-finding mind. And that spoiled that person's retreat. Or rather, it wasn't the person talking spoiled the retreat. It was the fault-finding mind. And you find when your mind is very sensitive, these things can happen so easily. It may be that someone snores during a meditation, or they sort of emit some awful smells, and you think, they shouldn't do this. Now, we shouldn't have so many beans on a retreat. This shouldn't happen. That's just, again, fault-finding mind. Stop all of that, because that's a hindrance to the meditation. Fault-finding. This is a cause for Vyapada, an obstacle, because you can see how it obstructs the mind. It's just another area where I can spend a lot of time thinking. And you know there is a certain pleasure with finding fault. When you find fault with someone else, you feel superior. That's usually the pleasure of fault finding, feeling superior, or excusing one's own faults by picking out the faults of others. So be careful of that fault-finding mind. Know its pleasure. Know why one gets caught up in it. Know it as a hindrance, as an obstacle to those beautiful states of peace where you can't find fault with anything. And let it go. The last aspect of Vyapada, which I like to mention, is the ill will towards your meditation object, which again is a very subtle form of the second hindrance. And sometimes this can develop in a long retreat. The meditation object is the breath. And sometimes you can find yourself at the beginning of a sit, crossing your legs, sitting down, I've got to watch that blooming breath again. Here we go again. And if you enter the meditation with such negativity, it's called Vyapada towards the meditation object. It's going to be an obstacle. There's no way that you can maintain your attention on the breath if you hate it. There's no way you can stay sitting down peacefully if you just hate what you're doing. So that's why that one has to be very careful not to develop Vyapada towards the breath. I know at least one monk who actually disrobed and left the monkhood because the biggest obstacle to his meditation, what was stopping him, was simply Vyapada towards the breath. He hadn't gained very good instructions at the beginning when he started meditating on the breath. And so for 1 or 2 years, his meditation on the breath was getting him nowhere. And it led to frustration. And just aches and pains would just endure sitting for the hour. And because of, like, meditation was not fun, was just endurance, he developed this hatred towards the breath. this ill will towards the breath, which made the meditation on the breath almost impossible. The only way you could stay on the breath was with brute willpower. He was meant to do it, not with love, not with softness, not with gentleness. Not because he liked to see the breath, more like because he had to see the breath. This is what we're supposed to do, isn't it? Watch the breath in our meditation. If that's what, the only reason why you watch the breath, because it's what you have to do, you find it impossible. As I mentioned before, the only way you can maintain attention on the breath is to develop a mind which loves to watch the breath, which delights in watching the breath, which, just given the first opportunity, will just go to the breath like a dear old friend. But I do like that simile of looking upon the breath as a dear old friend. And that simile is especially apt for the Samadhi Nimitta, the dear old friend who's taken you to such beautiful places, with whom you've had just such blissful times in the past. Because when you can look upon the breath and the Samadhi Nimitta with the same feelings as a dear old friend, it brings up all these feelings of joy and happiness as soon as you get a glimpse of these things. As soon as you get a glimpse of them, then the mind just goes towards it straight away, as if your dear old friend was on the opposite side of the street while you were busy shopping. You would leave your shopping aside and just cross the street to go and have a coffee with your dear old friend. This is what happens with the breath. Once the beautiful breath starts to appear across the street, you stop all of what you're doing, you go along to visit your dear old friend, the beautiful breath. You've had such marvelous times before. You visited first jhana, and second jhana, and third jhana, and fourth jhana. My dear old friend, let's talk about our good old times again. And so you tend to go towards that out of love, rather than out of feeling it's something you have to do. So, see if you can understand what I mean by why a pada towards your meditation object. So that the ill will, the negativity, I have to do this, but I don't really want to. I have to meditate for 1 hour, because it says so in the program. I'm doing this because I'm too embarrassed to say, this is hopeless, I'm leaving, when you've paid so much money and everyone else is sitting here. It's going to appear like a failure. And get some like love for this meditation. And after a while, that you can develop. Once you have love for the meditation, meditation is very easy. So be careful why a pada. It's a huge obstacle. And the way to overcome why a pada, ill will, traditionally, the Buddha said, was through loving kindness, through metta. The loving kindness is that which can't see anything wrong with anything. Purely emotional, irrational, illogical, just love, kindness, warmth, goodwill. And that's why yesterday I was talking about goodwill towards the breath. To have a sense of love towards the breath. Because many people, if you've been meditating a long time and you haven't got really profound, beautiful results yet, sometimes you can develop that ill will towards the breath, and it needs to be conquered by a sense of kindness and care and love towards the breath. Just using one's imagination, using thought to imagine the breath as something such as soft and selfless thing which has been serving me all my life. The breath has never asked anything back from me, and it's just been feeding me oxygen, taking away all the waste gases, all the toxins. It's done this without complaint ever since I was born. How more selfless can one be? And so one feels a sense of gratitude and kindness and warmth and love towards the breath. It's a strange thing that I've seen that parents who love their children, it doesn't matter how horrible and nasty and selfish and terrible their children are, they're always glad to see those children. Let alone when their children were good, then they really love to see them. But all parents love to see their kids when their kids come and visit. in the same way that if one has the same love towards one's breath, as soon as it appears, one just loves to see it. One welcomes it into one's mind. And one doesn't sort of have this aversion, like with some visitors. When are they going to go? So with the breath, we welcome it. When we welcome it, we nurture it. It stays. It stays in our consciousness. And we find that we can keep awareness on the breath with no problem whatsoever. So the way to overcome ill will, aversion to the breath, or to fault finding, or to out and out hatred, is through loving kindness. Develop the softness of the mind. And indeed, to gain the blisses in meditation, you do need a very soft and gentle mind. Not the harsh, hard, US Marine type mind. Just go in there and blast everyone. You end up blasting yourself as well. You go in there without the soft, gentle mind, with the breath, and you find it far more effective. The third hindrance is tinamida, which is sloth and torpor. Now, as mentioning, that's connected to the first hindrance, the sensory desire, because there is a sense of pleasure in just dulling out and just sleeping. There was one novice in Ajahn Chah's monastery in Thailand who used to sleep so much, wouldn't come up in the early morning for the morning chanting, and the first chance he would get after the meal would be back to his hut, laid out, snoring, well, not snoring, but fast asleep. And he used to go around, usually the Buddha saying is, Nibbana is the highest happiness. Nibbana is the highest happiness. And he was going around telling all the monks, sleep is the highest happiness. Sleep is the highest happiness. And there is a sense of pleasure in sleepiness. You don't have to worry or be concerned about doing anything. The world doesn't... The world isn't irritating you anymore when you're sleepy. You just go into a beautiful dream world. However, that be careful of that nice taste of sleepiness, because again, there is something which is much, much more beautiful than being dozy, being sleepy. It's okay being peaceful, but it's more wonderful to be there while you're being peaceful, so you can really enjoy what peace is. So sloth and torpor is quite a dangerous hindrance. It's one of the hindrances which often comes up when you do a lot of meditation. Because after a while, the mind, which is trying to concentrate, often rebels. And just says, that's enough. Enough work. Now I'm just going to go off into sleep, into doziness. And it is why this is a very important teaching. It's why the Buddha suggested that people who are doing a lot of samadhi practice is to balance the day. Put aside some time for samadhi practice, some time for rousing energy, and some time for equanimity, just letting go. If you just do samadhi, just watch the breath, 18, 19, 20 hours, you'll find that you'll get into dullness almost without fail. The mind needs some sort of enjoyment. Unless you get into jhanas, where you overcome such things very easily as the soft and torpor, the mind becomes really energized. If you can't do that, then spend some time each day going out into the garden and just enjoying the beauty of the garden. Just giving the mind some rest from development, as it were. I sometimes call it, when I talk to monks, as throwing the dog a bone. Giving the mind just some sort of pleasure. Because if you do that, if you throw the dog a bone, then it's quiet for a long time. So just indulge in just sitting under a tree, not watching your breath, not doing walking meditation, just listening to the birds, or just seeing the trees, experiencing the wind in one's face. And I was surprised at first when I saw these sorts of teachings in practice, that some of the most renowned meditation monasteries in Thailand, some of the strictest places with the fiercest teachers, when it came time for tea time at the monastery, the abbot, I remember, like Ajahn Mahabua, one of the fiercest, most respected meditation teachers in Thailand, would come out and he would sit with the monks and just joke and crack jokes and just laugh. Because he realized there was a time when the monks needed just to relax, let off steam. Because otherwise, the intensity of aiming for samadhi, for jhanas, aiming, would make you too tense, would make the mind hard, and that hardness would lead to sloth and torpor. So if you're having trouble with sloth and torpor, with dullness during this retreat, very often it's just the mind in rebellion, saying, enough of samadhi, I want a bit of fun. So take the mind out into the garden. Just look at the flowers for half an hour. Let the mind go. And then after half an hour, bring it back in again. And you find having, as I say, thrown the dog a bone, it's much more amenable to being controlled and told what to do. And that's how you can get rid of the sloth and torpor. There are other nasho ways of getting rid of sloth and torpor, such as sitting on a precipice. You can sit on sort of one of those chairs outside, just right at the very, very edge, so you know that just one nod and you're off. Another thing you can do in the morning, you can put some toothpaste on your brush and put it on top of your head. A lot of toothpaste on your brush, so you know that if you nod and you get sleepy, the toothbrush will make a mess all over you, all over the floor, or whatever. Little things like that. It's like the masha way in which people overcome sloth and torpor. The alternative becomes really unpleasant. However, I prefer wisdom to overcoming sloth and torpor, rather than these harsh methods. Sloth and torpor is one of the last hindrances which go for the meditator. And so, quite frankly, I'm not too worried about sloth and torpor appearing in meditators. There was one story which really stands out in the suttas, where the Buddha saw these two monks. One was sitting next to, just on the edge of a village. He was sitting absolutely straight, perfect posture. And the Buddha told his monk, said, "I'm worried about that monk. Because he's sitting next to the village, even though he's dead straight, no sloth and torpor yet, he's in danger of getting lost in sensory desire, just because of where he's sitting." And a few minutes later, he went into the forest, and he saw another monk sitting, nodding and drooping. And the Buddha said, "I'm pleased with that monk. Even though he's got the hindrance of sloth and torpor, he's away from the forest, he's away from the village, deep in the forest. He will soon overcome that sloth and torpor, and he will gain deep samadhi." It's the first hindrance is far more dangerous, far more strong an obstacle to samadhi than sloth and torpor. Sloth and torpor is just you're on the edge of samadhi. You just need that bit more mindfulness, a bit more energy, and you get through into some beautiful, peaceful state. So sloth and torpor was an obstacle which even the Buddha regarded as not as dangerous as some of the others. Again, one of the best ways of overcoming sloth and torpor is just by cranking up your mindfulness, especially at the beginning. Paying more attention to the breath instead of just taking it for granted, really looking deeply at it. Another good way of overcoming sloth and torpor, and this
is quite relevant to a few people here, is to do the meditation on death, Maranasati. And a few people here attended the funeral of Karu, who was one of the workers at our Buddhist center, and who died very suddenly. One moment he was full of energy, healthy, apparently, didn't realize what was happening in his arteries, and within 10 days of noticing there was something wrong, he was dead. If ever you're sleepy, just think of what's happening in your arteries right now, or what could be happening in your arteries right now. Just think of that little sort of, can you feel that little ache around your chest somewhere? And is it going down the arms? Is this a sign? So what it's actually doing there is just remember your mortality. And you think, uh-oh, how many days have I got? How many hours have I got? How many minutes have I got? As soon as you start thinking of death, your death, not someone else's, imagine yourself the pains of a heart attack. Imagine yourself being in the ICU unit with all these doctors hurrying around you, putting this tube in, that tube in. Imagine them turning off all the switches. You're gone. Dead. That soon wakes you up. Because it's a truth of our life that death is unknown. The time of death is unknown. And if this was going to be your last hour, you'd never be sleepy. So Maranasati, imagining you're going to die soon. This very hour, this very minute. Then you find that you'll be fully alert, fully awake. And mindfulness is very easy to rouse. So Maranasati, the mindfulness on death, to be used for overcoming that third hindrance. The fourth hindrance is restlessness and worry. And that's the Buddha described that as like water being agitated by the wind. Or it's like being like a slave, always being told what to do. Come here, go there, do this, do that. That's what restlessness and worry is. Restlessness is always pushing you around. Don't be pushed around by these thoughts and demands of restlessness and worry. Stand up for yourself and say, no, I'm not going to be a slave. The restlessness and worry very often comes from fear. The fear of letting go. The fear of being still. Because many people have been so used to doing things, being occupied with going somewhere or getting something, that they're always restless. They never actually reside in where they are. They can never just let go and be at peace. Always continual doers. And when you understand that restlessness is coming from this doing mind, you understand that the way to achieve these blissful states of meditation, to overcome that fourth hindrance, is to develop the passive mind. Just the mind which knows, the mind which experiences, not the mind which does and makes decisions. That's the source of restlessness. When you make decisions and you act and you do this and you do that, and you start giving orders and you start making plans. The doing mind is to be abandoned and the knowing mind is to be developed. And that's the way to overcome restlessness and worry. And that restlessness is a very strong hindrance, because that goes very deep into the meditation restlessness. And that restlessness becomes one of the very last hindrances which one has to overcome before one enters into a jhana. You find that you try to watch the breath, but these other things sort of interfere. That's restlessness. You can't just rest on the breath. You get full attention on the breath, and you can't really hold it there. Be careful, because the reason why you can't hold the full continual awareness of the breath is because you're interfering with it. It's restlessness. You won't allow yourself just to leave it alone. and the awareness of the breath will just remain by itself. Especially when the samadhi nimitta arises, there you have to be very careful of restlessness, because you're getting a very refined object in the mind. You've already got it there. Leave it alone. Don't do anything. Hold your breath, as it were. I mean, don't act. Just watch. That's the time especially where you have to really develop the passive mind, which leaves it alone. Remember that simile I gave yesterday of the modern aeroplanes, just with the dog and with the captain? Captain's there to feed the dog's there to bite the captain if he touches anything. That's what you should do in this stage of meditation. The dog being mindfulness, which bites you as soon as you start to do anything. Leave it alone. Let go. Be at peace. And you find the samadhi nimitta is there by itself. Remains by itself. You don't need to hold on to it. It's like anything which is very subtle. I gave the simile of like a flower. If you're holding a flower, if you hold it too tightly, you crush it. That's restlessness. If you hold it too loosely, it falls from your grip. That's sloth and torpor. In between is this beautiful balance point of just knowing, clearly knowing, but not doing, which is the midpoint between sloth and torpor and restlessness and worry. So restlessness and worry is overcome just by doing this letting go, becoming the passive mind. You're letting go of the controlling mind, the doing mind. If there are times when restlessness is very strong, if you try and suppress the restlessness, in other words, you try and do away with restlessness, it usually gets worse. Develop the passive mind. So you just watch restlessness without interfering with it at all. You're truly just being at peace with it, letting it go. You find it will just burn itself up. Ajahn Chah used to give the simile of a leaf which is fluttering on a tree. The way to get that leaf to become still is stop the wind. The wind of control. Once the wind stops, the leaf will continue fluttering, but less and less and less and less, until it uses up all of its energy through friction, and then it comes to a stop. In the same way, if you're really restless, develop a passive mind. Don't try and control it. Fully passive mind, and the restlessness will just burn itself up and will disappear. And the last of the hindrances is doubt. And that doubt is in two areas. Doubt about what you're supposed to be doing, and also doubt about whether you can do it anyway. Is it possible for me to gain jhanas? Can I do it? Have I got enough experience yet? Any doubt which comes up in your meditation is a hindrance. Doubt is overcome through faith and then through wisdom. So first of all, the doubt that you can do it is to be overcome through faith in yourself, confidence in yourself, and then finally wisdom, when you find, actually, hey, I can do it after all. Hey, what do you know? And also the instructions. Faith in the method, confidence in the method. At least I hope that I've given clear enough instructions, and I'll continue with these instructions throughout the week, in how to develop the mind. So the manual should be very clear. I know that some manuals, you read them, you can't make head nor tail of what they're trying to say. So there'll obviously be doubts in what to do. But if the instructions are very clear, then there should be no doubt what you're supposed to be doing. However, sometimes you may forget. And that forgetfulness is called a lack of mindfulness. Mindfulness is that which tells you what's going on now, but also which remembers the instructions. The mindfulness which remembers the instructions will overcome the doubt. You will know what needs to be done. But in particular, there's another very refined type of doubt which comes up later on in one's meditation, in the deeper stages. It's the doubt which comes as a thought, what should I do next? You may, for example, get the first glimpse of the Samadhi Nimitta, and you say, what do I do next? And as soon as you say that, it goes. The point is not what you're doing next, it's what you're doing now, is the question. What you're doing next, what should I do next, is doubt. What am I doing now is mindfulness. Mindfulness should be cultivated, doubt should be abandoned. So all those thoughts, questions in the mind which are of the form, what should I do next? Know them as doubt. What am I doing now? It's mindfulness. That's to be developed, doubt to be abandoned. The Samadhi Nimitta has already come up, great. Leave it alone. You've got there. Don't need to do anything. And as such, that the Samadhi Nimitta will remain. The doubt is called like muddy water. Water which is just filled with all sorts of impurities that one cannot really see deeply into it. The thought, should I do this, should I do that, is this right, what should I do next? So overcome that doubt by making the water very, very clear. So be clear about what you should do, how you are what the process of meditation is. And then always be very careful of this thought, what should I do next? And pay more attention to what you're doing now. So that's the talk this morning on the five hindrances, which all obstacles to meditation you'll find will be one or other of those five hindrances. So notice, if you've got an obstacle to meditation, if you're not getting into bliss states by the third day, ask yourself why. Why? And remember, it was not a sixth hindrance. Some people think the biggest hindrance is, I can't do this, my inability. That was not a hindrance in the Buddha's list of obstacles to success in meditation. So it's not that you can't do it. It's one of these hindrances is blocking you. Find out which one it is, or which combination it is. Know it very clearly, what the obstacle is. And then remember ways of overcoming it. And then bit by bit, you'll make great progress in the meditation. Now, are there any questions about what I've just been talking about? Yeah?
In our retreats, we have periods of sitting meditation, and then walking meditation, and it's just sort of a fairly low level of physical activity. Reading about the Zen tradition, it seems that they sometimes meditate and then
You're asking that in some traditions they spend a period of a retreat doing very intense, fast, energetic physical activity, and is that very useful? It can be useful to some types of people, especially if they're very, very young novice meditators who have obviously got a lot of energy to burn off. But looking around the people here, you're mostly like middle-aged and a bit older and being very diplomatic. And one doesn't have that same sort of energy which is needed to be burnt off. I noticed that in the monasteries in Thailand. You get like little novices of 7 or 8 years of age sometimes, and youth of 18, 19, early 20s. And they just had so much energy in them, you needed some way of burning it off. However, even for middle-aged people, that if you find yourself getting very dull and sleepy, then that's good to go and do some vigorous physical exercise. Because that actually tends to wake you up. You can do some push-ups when you first get up in the morning. and it sort of gets you enlivened. However, if you do too much of rapid physical activity, it does tend to disturb the mind, because the mind has to follow along with this rapid energetic activity. You can very easily get caught up in it and lose a lot of peace. I think my answer to that would be that it really depends if it's very young meditators. That's usually where they ask for a lot of rapid activity. Yes? You're asking that sometimes that another way of overcoming stop and torpor is, especially after a meal, is to stand up. If there's any problems doing that here, and there's no problems doing that here if you wish to do so. And it is a way of overcoming stop and torpor. I do remember one monastery where they used to do that after the meal. They used to stand for 2 hours. And the only way you could actually do that was to developing some sort of samadhi. One of Ajahn Chah's methods of overcoming stop and torpor, I mentioned this in a talk some weeks ago at Dolamara, is after the meal, especially during the summertime when it's very, very hot and humid, you put all the monks in this small room with a tin roof, close all the windows. You had to put all your robes on. You were allowed to take extra blankets if you wished. Then everyone would be sitting there, sort of sweating. And it became so uncomfortable physically that the only way that you could deal with that is becoming very mindful. So it didn't make it very easy. So that way you learned how to develop your own energy rather than just relaxing too much.
With stopping torpor and your will, might a way of dealing with it also be to consider it in terms of the oppressiveness of the state of mind of torpor? There's a craving that's involved in it, and the mind is clinging to that diamond. And then by trying to sort of release the desire or the craving, to sort of bring the mind to release that and sort of perceive that release in association with the breath, so the breath becomes like a refuge from the oppressive state.
It can be, yes, as a skillful means, if you're having stop and torpor, to use that the breath is like a release, the refuge from the oppressiveness of sloth and torpor. The problem is, though, with sloth and torpor especially, that once sloth and torpor is established in the mind, it sort of it stops mindfulness, allows it rising up. And you, it's like a person being drunk. You don't realize you're drunk. And so many people, I mean, you know in your experience, they're drunk and they say, I'm not drunk, as they stagger around the floor. And sloth and torpor is similar. It's a drunken mind which is staggering all over the place, but it doesn't know what to do. It hasn't got the mindfulness or the power to make the right decisions. So it's a difficult one with sloth and torpor, because if you had the mindfulness there in the first place to be able to exit from sloth and torpor, you wouldn't have sloth and torpor. It's much better to avoid sloth and torpor when it first arises up. And that's why it's good at the beginning of a meditation to make the first 5 minutes of a meditation really strong. If the first 5 minutes you put a lot of effort into your meditation, the chances are sloth and torpor won't rise up. However, if you're a bit slack in the first 5 minutes of your meditation, and sloth and torpor come into your mind, you've got a hard job in front of you eradicating it.
In relation to the ignorance of ill will, when like a painful sensation arises in the mind, if one ignores it, but holds on to this desire not to have the sensation.
Yeah.
My way of dealing with that would be to, again, consider the oppressiveness of that condition arising from the desire of the aversion, not to have, desire not to have. And by releasing that, help the mind to take refuge in the breath by perceiving the breath as sort of a release.
Yeah, you're also asking about using the breath as a refuge, as a release from physical pains. And indeed, you've also mentioned like the ill will which can be associated with physical pains or any other unwanted distraction. And indeed, that it's good to notice that whenever there is a distraction which is unwanted, there is the unpleasantness of the distraction itself, but it's also the reaction you give it in your mind. You know, there's the two types of pain, physical, the external pain, and the mental pain of ill will, aversion, I don't want. And if you know both of those as different things, at the very least, you can always abandon the I don't want. You can't abandon the unpleasantness of the feeling sometimes, but at least you can halve the dukkha by getting rid of the mental aspect of the dukkha. But indeed, that again, physical feelings of pain in the body, if you can get into a decent samadhi by in the first few minutes, because when you start meditating, you know, you've been walking or you've been doing some other activity, and so the body is at its most comfortable, you know, the first 5 or 10 minutes when you're sitting. You always remember that and give the first 5 and 10 minutes in a full mindfulness. And that way, if you can get into a decent state of attention on the breath, then there's a good opportunity that in the first 5 or 10 minutes you'll get so close to the breath, the body will already fall away. And any physical feelings of aches and pains you just will not notice. So the first 5 and 10 minutes is your window of opportunity to really gain some sort of samadhi. Okay, I think we'll finish off a long session.